This is Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Studio O, just north of Philadelphia, in the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. As we continue the series of episodes on the Arctic, we ask here, who is telling the story of the region? Whose voices are heard? Tonight, we explore Vani Volstad, one of Svalbard's daughters, whose writings rewrite the Svalbard myth, that this Norwegian archipelago was no place for women, and a place only for certain kinds of men. We call episode 56, Writing the Arctic. On June 19th of this year, I made landfall at Horsund on the island of Spitsbergen in Svalbard as part of an expedition to this Arctic region. The natural landscape was stunning, the wildlife abundant at this time of year. But it was the old circa 1930s cabin of Vani Volstad that left such an impression on me that I wanted to find out more. Who was she? What was she doing there? Joining us is Dr. Ingrid Erberg from the Augustana campus of the University of Alberta in Canada, where she has taught for the last 25 years. She wrote Svalbard's Daughters, Personal Accounts by Svalbard's Female Pioneers, where she looks at the writings of a group of women who braved the Arctic winter and wrote about that experience. Her own narrative and research interests brought her to Svalbard back in the early 2000s, where she first found the story of Volstad.
So I teach Norwegian language and Scandinavian literature and culture courses, and one of those courses is actually called Personal Narratives of the North. My research interests include personal narratives, firsthand accounts of travels, and then also polar and northern literature. The Svalbard narratives have allowed me to combine those two areas. I've long been interested in, since I was a kid, the North, which of course is a very relative term. When I grew up in the Midwest in the U.S., North was northern Minnesota. So I've always been interested in the North, north of me, I guess, and then stories, oral and written. And so those two interests really have played into a number of my major life and professional choices, including studying in Norway as an undergrad, moving to Canada to work in the 90s, and also my working with colleagues in interdisciplinary ventures. So these interests have also led to course development for me. So in the early 2000s, I worked with a colleague in outdoor education, and we developed an interdisciplinary course that involved a visit to a homestead in the wilderness on the east arm of Great Slave Lake, which is in the Northwest Territories. And we combined dog sledding with the study of northern personal narratives. So I've long had these two interests. So it's natural that when I work with Scandinavian studies, I gravitated towards the north of Norway and Scandinavia, which is, of course, Svalbard. So when I had a sabbatical in the early 2000s, I guess it was 2001, I decided I'd go to Tromsø, which is in northern Norway, and see what I could find in terms of narratives. And in some years before that, I'd been on a cruise or a boat and ended up in Tromsø and the Polar Museum, and there's an exhibit there about a woman named Vani Volstad, and I became acquainted with her then. And when I was coming up with my sabbatical plan, I try to think of a creative way to get to the north, because for me that's a passion of mine. And what kind of research could I do? Something new. And I did a little bit of background work and discovered very little work had been done with personal narratives from Svalbard, and realized that a lot of work had been done with narratives by men that had lived there for extended periods, but very little work had been done with narratives by women. And I got curious, are there narratives? What are they about? And so I decided to put that into this research plan and spent then some months in Tromsø in 2001.
There is this popular imagination of the Arctic in some ways as being this masculine space. And is that myth or is that imagination so strong that you didn't even think that there were female narratives?
Not me.
All right.
Because I had long worked with narratives by women and works by women that had been overlooked.
Yeah.
So I wasn't actually, I mean, I didn't know about Bonnie Volstad, and I didn't know a lot about Svalbard at that point. But I wouldn't say that I was surprised, because I had, in my dissertation, in my working on my PhD, I'd worked with Norwegian-American women writers who were absolutely there but had been largely overlooked by the literary establishment. So I wasn't surprised, but I was very interested and intrigued by her story. Clearly, there weren't many women that spent winters on Svalbard, and I can talk more about that. She is very... she stuck out because she did something very unique. She was a pioneer in terms of hunting. But as I started to delve into women in Svalbard, I realized that, of course, there were many other women who were there, many other women who wrote about, or a number of other women who wrote about their experiences, and no one had looked at that collectively before. So it was an area that deserved further attention. But I, of course, was aware that the Arctic has been seen as a space for men, but I was ready to challenge that, I guess, in my research.
By bringing together different personal narratives that have, I mean, and these aren't just archived personal narratives. These are stories that have been published and have.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually also found some things in archives that I've worked a bit with, but I primarily have been working with published narratives. Exactly. So I do find it fascinating that the Arctic myth, or, you know, and of course the Arctic myth is a big one, but the Arctic has long been seen as a space for men who are physically and mentally tough, and women were not viewed as being tough enough or robust enough to deal with that isolation, you know, the dark, cold winters, or the physical challenges of the environment. They were seen as being too delicate. And I guess that, you know, it totally ignores the fact that indigenous women have been present in Arctic regions as long as they've been inhabited.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, that's what it has to do with another type of power structure. So I've been interested in that issue of how voices that maybe once were being listened to or were, for example, these narratives were paid attention to in their day, but then they sort of, some of them went by the wayside. You know, what causes that? Why do we forget voices, or why do we overlook them? And I do have to point out, of course, though, that Svalbard never had an indigenous population. So it was a place that many, or people generally viewed as a place unfit for human habitation in the beginning. So we can talk about the Arctic myth, and we can also talk about the Svalbard myths, and in terms of gender.
Yeah.
And they're related, but a little bit different.
Right. Svalbard definitely has that unique history, different than, say, the north of Canada, where you live, even the northern parts of Siberia, if we're starting to look across the whole, what we consider the Arctic, definitely
the circumpolar north, as we call it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a different history in terms of indigenous populations.
And of course, Svalbard has always been an international place. It was discovered or rediscovered, some would argue, in 1596 by William Barents. And then the whaling industry was the British and the Russians the Dutch were involved in that. Or I shouldn't say the Russians, the Dutch and the British. And then the hunting and trapping was taken over by the Russians and then the Norwegians. And today, of course, it continues to be an international place in terms of tourism and research. So it's always had the international, as people have lived there, it's had an international character.
That must complicate sort of any claim to a national narrative for Norwegians because of its internationality.
It does and it doesn't. The Norwegians absolutely, there are issues of Norwegian identity that are linked to Svalbard because Norway, as you know, has there's the Svalbard Treaty. So Norway has sovereignty since this treaty was signed in 1920, but since 1925 they've really administered Svalbard. So Norwegians do feel a connection and a sense of, you know, they're responsible for now protecting Svalbard and making sure that regulations are adhered to. So it really did allow Norwegians, it was primarily Norwegians and Russians that lived there, and the majority were Norwegians. So I would say that there still is a close connection between Norwegian identity and Svalbard. It's a big part of their narrative, actually. And you know, when the people started, when the Norwegian hunting became entrenched on Svalbard in the late 19th century, that was a time when Norway was trying to figure out who it was as a country, or Norwegians were trying to figure out what is it to be Norwegian. And that era coincided with Nansen's exploits in the Arctic, and then Roald Amundsen. And so when Norway became fully independent in 1905, they were trying to articulate who are we, and a polar nation became part of that identity.
Interesting. And the poster sort of person for that were the Arctic explorers.
Absolutely. So Fridtjof Nansen being the foremost.
Yeah.
And he really epitomized these manly ideals of being physically strong, mentally tough, he was a scientist and he also was a fine writer. He ended up winning the Nobel Peace Prize of all things. So he really was a influential person, and his polar exploits were absolutely used to sort of in this national narrative of what is Norway, who are we? And Roald Amundsen was part of that, Otto Sverdrup, and those hunters that went to Svalbard and the people that stayed over the winter there, that was something that they emulated, that type of life and that those types of exploits.
Yeah, are they conquering the Arctic?
The accounts by the polar explorers, the male polar explorers, tended to really celebrate kind of the domination, conquering conditions, that sort of thing. But one of the things I discovered in these narratives by women is that while these women went to Svalbard for a variety of reasons, and many of them accomplished feats that we would call heroic, like rescuing someone from a crevasse in the ice,
yeah,
or helping their kids out when they're attacked by some wild huskies, they don't focus on, that's not the primary focus. They don't look at the landscape as being an obstacle or something that has to be overcome, but something that helps them, something they coexist with. And these narratives are very transformative. They experience transformation while in Svalbard. They become more self-confident, self-aware, and experience a lot of joy. And that's very closely linked to landscape and to physical contact. Being on skis, being on snowshoes, later even snowmobiling, but this sort of connection to the land and realizing that in this space they can accomplish things that they were told they couldn't do, and they do, and they learn something about themselves. So they really find, as Virginia Woolf would say, a room of their own,
yeah,
when they go to Svalbard. Mm-hmm.
So the male polar narratives that are being written, the sort of reporting that the polar explorers bring back, is the language sort of reflective of that conquering, that domesticating the unknown? And then what you're finding in the female narratives, specifically here in Svalbard, is more of a dialogue with that landscape instead of a taming of the landscape, if you will.
Yeah, I think that sums it up. And they don't diminish, I'll have to say too, they're not underestimating the weather, the conditions, the tough conditions, or the dangers of the landscape, but rather than, there is that dialogue, they learn to deal with it, negotiate it, and it isn't something that they have to conquer. And there's a lot that's been written in this area, and I'm not an expert by any means in these exploration narratives by Norwegian men, but also by, you know, there's a lot, British and many polar explorers. But that trend has been identified in scholarship, that there is the sense that, you know, the virgin landscape that has to be dominated, that has to be entered, and these obstacles that have to be overcome. So danger is recognized, and there's respect for that, but they don't focus. They recognize it, but then they focus on what they can learn from it and how that helps them to develop as people. Yeah. And it's quite, they're quite poetic passages in these works. Some more poetic than others, but you know, detailed poetic, what I would call poetic passages.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
Back in June, I was on a ship that had zodiacs, you know, rib boats that took us on land in and around Svalbard. Mm-hmm. And at Hornsund, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, in the western side of Spitsbergen, we made landfall. And amongst the thousands of kittiwakes filling the sky and tens of thousands of guillemots nesting on the cliffs, the most important thing, or the thing I took my takeaway from that landing, was I got to see what is being framed as the cabin where Bonnie Volstadt lived with her two teenage sons. What can you tell us about, you know, we've started a little bit to discuss the writings in a broader context or in the bigger picture. What can you tell us about Bonnie Volstadt and her life, and then what she really did write, and what was her narrative?
Well, Bonnie Volstadt was a fascinating person, and she became in her day a bit of a local celebrity in northern Norway, and she still is today.
Yeah.
So she is known for being the first woman to participate in big game hunting on Svalbard on an equal basis with a male hunting partner. So that's what she did that was pioneering in nature.
Big game, but, meaning, what do you mean by big game?
Svalbard, yeah. Right. Big game on Svalbard would be polar bears.
Wow, yeah.
And it would also be seals,
uh-huh.
Reindeer. And also she was involved in trapping foxes, ptarmigan hunting and eggs and so forth. But the big game hunting, polar bears, reindeer, seals, and a couple of beluga whales at one point. So these were, you know, there's some highly dramatic situations that she describes in her narrative. But she wasn't the first woman to overwinter on Svalbard, to stay the whole winter. That was actually way back in 1898. She was there for five winters between 1932 and 1937.
Yeah.
And as you pointed out, she spent some of that time with her two teenage sons, but she was also with her life and work partner, Anders Sæterdal. And they were in that Hornsund area. Her teenage sons weren't there with her all the time. They joined her for periods, as did Sæterdal's children.
Okay.
And Bonnie Volstadt at this time had been widowed twice already. So she was in a common law relationship with Anders Sæterdal.
Uh-huh.
Her book didn't come out until 1956, so 20 years after she had, about 20 years after she left Svalbard. But an earlier edition of it actually appeared in something called the Norwegian Polar Yearbook. She wrote this narrative then in 56, or it came out, and it was very popular. And, you know, Bonnie Volstadt was a pioneering person. She was the first woman taxi driver in Tromsø. So she lived in this northern Norwegian city, which is known as, by many, it has a number of nicknames, one of them being the Paris of the North, but the other is the portal to the Arctic.
Sort of a gateway city.
Or gateway to the Arctic, yeah.
Yeah.
She knew how to, I'd say, promote her pioneering exploits. On the cover of her book, you have a picture of her standing over, it looks like, to me, a polar bear and a reindeer, but some people say she's standing over two polar bears. The quality's not very good. But at any rate, she's visually showing us that she had done something rather unique. So she was quite a strong woman physically, but also clearly very resourceful and managed extremely well. I mean, she had to deal with losing two husbands and then taking care of her two teenage sons. And she, in her narrative, talks about when she got this opportunity to go to Svalbard, she jumped at it. She didn't hesitate at all. This was something she really wanted to do. And people discouraged her and said, how are you going to manage a woman in the Arctic? But she did not doubt herself and clearly managed just fine. What's ironic and tragic about her situation is when she returned to Norway, she went on gave her book out, she went on speaking tours, and she was a popular lecturer.
Uh-huh.
And on one of her lecture tours for her book, it was in 1959, she was hit by a car and died. So she survived all of these very dangerous situations on Svalbard, and then she was hit by a car and tragically died. But she had achieved this type of celebrity status. And she's the best known, I would say, of the women who have written narratives about their time on Svalbard, at least in the past. And there's an exhibit about her, as I said, at the Polar Museum in Tromsø.
Yeah.
And if you go to Svalbard today and visit the Svalbard Museum, you'll notice that there's a book on sale there about hunters and trappers of Svalbard, and now her photo is on the cover of that history. So she's being used as sort of a representative of hunters and trappers. And she's even, you'll find her face plastered on chocolate boxes and souvenirs. So she's, as I said, she really has become kind of a Svalbard celebrity.
The Polar Museum in Tromsø, I'm curious how they're framing her, and has that framing changed over time? You're saying now she's on the cover of the book at the Svalbard Museum
it's a book on sale at the Svalbard Museum, but it's published in Norway, but it's on sale.
Okay, yeah. I mean, is there a move even in the museum and how, you know, she's being discussed? Has that shifted over time, do you think? Or
absolutely. And the narratives that I'm talking about today and the people I'm talking about, they experienced Svalbard and lived there, you know, before 2000, and their narratives, well, really in the 1930s through the 1970s. So that was a different era than today. And absolutely, things have changed. If the exhibit at the Polar Museum in Tromsø, that there Vani is portrayed as an exceptional woman, and she was. And I don't want to downplay what an exceptional person she was.
Right.
She was the first woman to participate in large game hunting on equal footing with a male partner. And so the exhibit there focuses on Vani as being an exceptional person, but they do talk about, I think they do mention that her sons were with her, and they point out that she wasn't, she was an extraordinary woman, but she also was fulfilling some of the roles that we would view as being very common roles of women in society. And it highlights the narrative that she wrote and notes that she was a popular lecturer and so on. So that's what the focus is there. But that exhibit has been there for a long time. But I will say that the Svalbard Museum's exhibits about women on Svalbard have changed a bit. When I was there in the early 2000s, they had an exhibit on the face about women and children on Svalbard, and they represented their experiences with faceless mannequins. So there was a woman, figure of a woman with no face, and a child with no face. And the point of that then was that there are these women and children that have been here for quite some time, but we haven't really been listening to or looking at or uncovering their stories as
yeah.
well as we could be. If you go to the Svalbard Museum today, which has been renovated and they've updated the exhibitions, those mannequins are no longer there, and they have exhibits about the faces of Svalbard or the people of Svalbard. And there, interestingly enough, the researcher is represented by a woman. There are stories from young people that have lived on Svalbard most of their lives. So there's now these stories have been uncovered. They're being paid attention to. So they're pointing out that I think think the change in the exhibit points out the attention that's being paid to these stories now, and the recognition that these stories are not being silenced anymore. They're there.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring academic and everyday geographical thinking together. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions, like how does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program or radio essay expedition that's broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrik in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world. Now let's get back to our episode.
The writings. We were talking about Vonnie Volstad. We also have Christina Ritter as well, who's Austrian, right? And then moves up to...
She's Austrian.
You mentioned just earlier, they're challenging this myth. How are they doing that? I mean, are they subversive? Are they strategic? Are they... They're not doing it the way it could be done maybe in the year 2000. They're doing it the way it was done in 1930, 40, and 50.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Could I tell you just a tiny little bit about Christina Ritter?
And sure.
Since she's also a very fascinating person, she lived to be 103 years old, actually. She just died in 2000. But as you said, she's an Austrian, and she lived on Svalbard in the 30s.
Yeah.
And she lived, Vonnie Volstad lived in Hornsund, sort of in the southwest. Christina Ritter and her husband and another man who was her husband's hunting partner lived on the northernmost tip of Spitsbergen in the 30s. And her husband was a scientist as well as a hunter. And she's known as the first European woman to spend a winter so far north. Like Vonnie Volstad, her account is quite popular, or was. It was published in German in 1938, came out in English in 1954, and then in Norwegian in 2002. And apparently... in the 90s, when she was 93 years old, she said that her wish was that her book would come out in Norwegian. And she also said Svalbard, life on Svalbard or Spitsbergen was the best year of her life. At any rate, she wrote her account down and published it much more quickly than Vonnie Volstad did. Though, as I said, Vonnie Volstad published a shorter version of her account shortly after she was on Svalbard. So they were contemporaries, and just through their descriptions of what they're doing, they demonstrate that women are tough enough physically and mentally to survive and stay over the winter. And this term overwinterer is a Norwegian term that is used to designate people, you know, that stay on Svalbard through the whole winter. And nowadays, okay, that isn't anything very extreme. There's modern communication and daily flights from the mainland.
Right.
But back in the 30s, people were cut off from the mainland for up to 10 months with, you know, the sea ice. So you were on your own in the winter. It could be a very challenging place to be. So people that were overwinterers before commercial air flights were established were held up as being something special in the Norwegian popular imagination. And so until very recently, until modern commercial air routes were established, women weren't necessarily viewed in the popular imagination as being really very fit for this, although many of them were there during the winter, particularly in the settlements.
Yeah.
So how did these women address this? Well, they described what they were doing, and they sort of just demonstrated that, indeed, they were okay. And these accounts are peppered with humor, and they are not they don't always take themselves too seriously. They want to show that they, you know, these are not dark, depressing works about, oh, I made it through the winter. They're yes, they look at some of serious situations and they face some tough times, but they also point out the joy that they have, that they derive from dealing with situations, and also just everyday humor and everyday tasks. So they sort of try to show that maybe this isn't, if you're prepared, as extreme as one would think, but it's possible to survive, and it's possible to do what we would consider regular everyday things. You bake your bread, you have a conversation with your partner, you read that old newspaper that you have sitting there. And they're particularly vivid descriptions of using skis and sleds, boats and so on to sort of navigate the land and the ice and the sea to accomplish their work, which and maybe work that's traditionally viewed as being women's work, and also what's traditionally viewed as being men's work. So, for example, there's a very dramatic scene when in Vonnie Volstad's work where she rescues her partner who's fallen down a crevasse, and it's a very serious situation, but she manages to do it. And so we're sort of given that information in the books. As I said, when they're confronting these dangerous situations posed by the weather conditions or the sea ice or polar bears, they're highly dramatic, but the focus tends to be on the things that they learn from the situation, a sense of accomplishment, and how they're learning to coexist with this. And in Christina Ritter's work, she finds herself alone in this cabin. I mean, she's not participating in the big game hunting with her husband and his partner.
Yeah.
She does a lot of other things, but she's trapped in the cabin, or can't really leave the area for 8-9 days during a snowstorm, and it's challenging for her, but she survives it by herself, and afterwards she takes a celebratory ski, you know, and she feels sort of joyful, like, I've managed to do this, and she's kind of contacting that space and that environment. They write about the landscape and the conditions, I would say, in such a way that they're challenging that myth that it has something that has to be conquered. They're living with it. They're negotiating it.
Yeah.
If you use the term, they're having a conversation with it, or they're in dialogue with it. So I think those are all things that they do. And another thing that I have found interesting in their works, I have in working with these before, I said they're sort of subversive at times, and I say that because they're very, very inclusive. You know, they're subversive in that they start by drawing us in by telling us how unusual they are. Like Vonnie Volstad's book is called, if you translate the title literally, the first, it's the first female hunter on Svalbard. But if you look at the word, she uses the term for the first female male hunter on Svalbard, and I won't get into that now, but she sort of draws us in, I'm really unique, you have to read my account. And she got Helge Ingstad, who's a well-known figure in the Arctic, if she got him or the publisher did, but he is a big name, had a lot of authority. He wrote the preface, and he talked about how unique and unusual she was. So in a sense, she's saying, I'm not threatening.
Yeah.
I'm different. This was not threatening a myth. I'm a unique person. But when you read her narrative, you know, at first she's talking about all of these, you know, the big game hunting, my first polar bear, and we see that, oh boy, she's doing something different. But gradually she starts to mention things like her children, baking bread, doing everyday things. And she also at one point says, dear housewives and others, she includes recipes for them. So she's including them. And she's saying, you know what? This isn't only for me. Other women can be here. This is something I can share with other people. This isn't just for a certain type of men. And that was a Svalbard myth. Not only that it was for, it wasn't just that it was for men, that women weren't necessarily suited for it, but it was for a certain type of man as well. And we tend to focus a lot on that hunter experience there. But you have to keep in mind that there were other women who were there who were maybe not doing things that were viewed as being pioneering, but they were providing support, and their stories are just as important. And so I worked with some of those narratives as well. So I think they try to include other people through sort of narrative devices, and Christina Ritter, another woman, Ingrid Peterson, does it as well. So they try to encourage people to embark on their own journeys as well, whether that be through reading or physically.
That is a narrative of inclusion versus, again, to maybe make some comparisons to the highly masculine sort of narratives of probably, I'm so heroic, you can't do this, but I can. So it's distancing themselves from that sort of heroic voice, but trying to include others.
Mm-hmm. And I can just like read a couple of quotes, like Volstead.
Yeah.
She mentions how housewives, direct quote, dear housewives and everyone else who is interested. Really, they're both trying to draw us in, and Christina Ritter at one point sort of refers to housewives in Austria. So they're trying to include others in their account, yes, and sort of demystify the situation.
Right. It does have that power of demystification to try to say that you can do this, you could be here too.
And I mean, it really is challenging. It's subversive because it's challenging the power structures in a way. To say that also that other things are important. I mean, what do we value? What do we pay attention to? What do we listen to?
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Do you have an idea for an episode or want to give some feedback? Go to the comments section on the website or to the blog and enter into the conversation. Now let's get back to our expedition.
How about the writing itself?
I don't have access to anything where she discussed the writing process except what we have in her narrative.
Uh-huh.
And in the narrative, she talks about how she and Amdish Seatherdal would sit down and write their journal every night. And it's something called Fangstmannsdagbøker, which are the hunter's journals. It's a genre in itself. The Norwegian hunters and trappers who lived on Svalbard, many of them from 1850 up to, the 1950s, 60s, they wrote these journals, and they were highly formulaic. You had to write about the weather and what you'd caught, and, it was just to remember what you'd done that day. At any rate, she would write in this journal at night, and after she had done something that was particularly exciting and dangerous, she wrote this in the journal and she checked with him, like, what do you think about this? So she did keep a record back then. And then her first account of this, as I said, was published in... So she wrote it down or revised it when she had returned home in 1935, I think it was. Or, sorry, 37. And then it was published in the Norwegian Polar Yearbook, of a shorter version of this text. So I don't really know if she worked with someone on refining this. Her name, she is listed as the author. I'm assuming she wrote the whole thing. She probably had some editors that helped her. But All I know is that she kept a record of her daily accomplishments and activities while on Svalbard, which was extremely typical.
Yeah. So there is an official archive? Is it at the Polar Museum or?
Yeah. There's extensive archival material in Tromsø. So going back to your first question, when I was there on my sabbatical in 2001, I spent many, many weeks at the archives, and that's how I uncovered these narratives. And I looked at published and unpublished materials and background information. So I used the, I didn't use any archives at the Polar Museum. I looked at the exhibits there, but there's something called the Norwegian Polar Institute in Tromsø, and they have a library and an archive. So I used the materials there, and there's also the Tromsø Museum, and they have some materials there. There's also a woman named Marit Anahauen, who has published in the area of the female hunters and trappers on Svalbard. And I think it's important when you talk about work. I mean, I'm the first person who's looked at these narratives collectively, or was the first person to do so. But of course, it always builds on the work that these women did, but also work that other people had done.
Sure.
And Marit Anahauen was very helpful. And now people have continued to work with this material as well. So yeah. But there are archives, and that's the best place in Norway to go if you're working with polar literature because of the extensive archive. Absolutely.
I'm just trying to think, you know, you're bringing this to the surface, so to speak. You're literally taking it out of the archive, reading through it, and then writing about it, and probably starting a process that may get a greater attention at rethinking and reconsidering the sort of contributions of these narratives of these women. Where could this go? Where do you think this could go?
Yeah. Well, I think there's been a lot of work done with this since I published this article that you had located what was it, 2007, I guess this article came out, Svalbard's Daughters.
Right.
I think that there's been a lot of scholarly attention paid to Arctic discourses in the past 20 years. I think this article has already, I've been sort of pleased of all the people that have contacted me that have used it. And there was even a theater, asking where it can go, there's a theater company in northern Norway that read this article, and then they read Bonnie Bolstad's work, Christina Ritter's, and Ingrid Pedersen, and they made a play based on these works. So it's already been sort of performed for the public. So I think there's a lot of potential for these works. And I think some people have already built on this article and the individual works. And so it could go many, many ways. And I think there's a lot of potential for the material. And I really was, I wish I would have seen that play in northern Norway. I didn't know about it until I saw it online somewhere. But I think it's wonderful to disseminate research in that fashion because it reaches a much broader audience.
Yeah.
And,
you're engaging with these different publics, different audiences or publics. And I think these stories, I think by not only the way they were written, Dear Housewives, but also, you know, the way they were written are trying to engage and include people. I think the way that they're going to be, you say, disseminating or diffusing sort of and traveling these documents, these narratives themselves can travel across space and time, and people can read them in different places. Now in the 21st century, we read them certainly with different eyes, but then is going to help us reconfigure the way we think about the Arctic, certainly Svalbard specifically, but maybe the Arctic in general. A theater company wanting to, you know, engage with a more sort of everyday audience to bring these narratives to light, to bring these stories to light, to have people reconsider again the way they think about certain people and places. How academic circles? Yeah. I mean, are there more conferences now that are Arctic? You're on the inside, so I'm sure you know all about them, but are they engaging, these Arctic conferences, are they engaging with wider groups of academics and policymakers? Is the Arctic becoming something that's you know.
Yeah, it's huge.
Yeah.
It's really, really getting a lot of attention, and it should. Especially when you think about what's happening in our world. And, I mean, it's Arctic, too. It's so closely linked to national security, international security, but also with the climate issues that we face. I mean, it's really, you know, front and center. But also with the whole move towards, you know, also, for example, in Canada, it's very important to us as we deal with issues of reconciliation.
Right.
And how long, you know, the whole issue, the issues surrounding colonization and uncovering voices that have always been there, but that have, that the colonizers in the West has chosen to ignore. So, I mean, it's really very big. And there are big research projects like Arctic Discourses, Arctic Modernities. There are many initiatives in the Arctic in terms of education and collaborations that are going on. And I think a real awareness. I mean, that's something about this project. I mean, it's a bigger overarching issue. You know, why are these myths constructed? Why have these accounts been ignored? I mean, it has to do with power structures and the whole publishing industry, right? Whose accounts were published? Who was encouraged to write? What was reviewed? What was deemed of value and interest? And it's sort of a reminder to us, I think, that we're doing things like that today that we're not even aware of. So it's sort of just a reminder to think about that everyone's story is valuable and it's important to listen to different voices. But there's a lot of attention, that being said, given to the Arctic today and in research circles. And I think that is, you know, if you start delving into it, you'll discover that there are not only conferences, but projects and connections that are being made between the peoples of the North and, you know, they're trying to bridge the gap between sort of traditional knowledge and stories and other types of you know, like science, certain types of scientific projects and so on. So there's a lot being done, both in the areas of science and humanities. And I think sometimes humanities get overlooked a bit, but with this project that I'm, you know, these narratives are linked to story and what it is to be a human in a particular place. I think there's a lot of potential, absolutely, for further work.
Mm-hmm. And is that the, I guess, to end on this, with the humanities, you know, I look at the Arctic is gaining attention in popular press. National Geographic is talking about it. The new Cold War might be have something to do with the Arctic, and they don't mean cold because it's cold in the North, but because there are political tensions and geopolitical sort of territorial questions that are going to be at play. Is the humanities question here, is there a battle for who gets to tell the story of the Arctic?
There always has been and always will be, I would say. And that is absolutely, there will always be that tension.
Right.
And I think by becoming, that's sort of what I was trying to say, that we need to always be aware of, think critically when we hear a story. Who told that story? What was their motivation? What are they trying to accomplish with that? And it's so important to listen to different voices, I think, to get a complete picture or a more complete picture of a situation. And, I mean, as in terms of humanities, what we're trying to do, of course, is, and I mean, education in general, educate people or encourage people, facilitate critical thinking, developing those skills, because for all of us, as we live our lives and vote and you know, become engaged in various issues, we have to be thinking critically and always with a critical eye. Well, okay, that's one perspective. Who said it? Why? And whose perspective is not being represented here? So I think always there's that question about narrative and that what we can do as people, you know, as human beings, is to try to think critically and identify the different perspectives and motivations change, times change. But I think the critical thinking is important. It continues to be very, very important, always will be, because there's never one side of the story. There's always many sides and many voices, and we need to think about that when we think about complex issues in the world.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Ingrid, for joining us from Alberta, Canada. Thanks for all your time.
Thank you.
So we come to the end of another episode. This is our fourth in the Arctic series. Looking forward to at least two more. Still asking questions, still thinking about the Arctic after the expedition there in June. Thanks to Ingrid Erberg once again for sharing her research with us. Hopefully we can open up even another public audience for her scholarship, but also for these important Svalbard narratives when the episode drops to iTunes. Thanks to Mike Allen, as always, for use of his song Sand Dune. For those interested in finding out more, Ingrid Erberg's Svalbard Daughters, Personal Accounts by Svalbard's Female Pioneers, is an article findable online. And there you'll find or encounter rich bibliographic references to the works of Vonnie Volstead and Christine Ritter. Ritter's book, Woman in the Polar Night, originally written in German, her mother tongue, and it's sold 500,000 copies already and has been translated into 7 languages, including English, Norwegian, and Spanish. I conclude episode 56, Writing the Arctic, with something said before on this show, that this digging into the archives, the act of resurfacing the work of the poets, of the stories of old, of ways of thinking, is such vital work as we navigate the trajectory of our lives and become cartographers of the worlds in which we live. Stay tuned for the next episode when we look at the life of the polar bear on the ice and in the media. Thanks. Ciao.